From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, David and Nick Sheff, the father-son duo behind the movie Beautiful Boy.
You think that you have this under control. Mm-hmm. And I understand how scared you are.
I understand why I do things. It doesn't make me any different, all right? I'm attracted to craziness, and you're just embarrassed because I was like, you know, I was like this amazing thing, like your special creation or something, and you don't like who I am now.
Yeah, who are you, Nick?
This is me, Dad. Here, this is who I am.
Also today, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh on his agenda for 2019 and much more.
If we want to address inequality in our communities, let's fund education. If we want to address racism in our communities, let's fund education. That's what we have to do. Yeah.
Call us at 1-800-423-8255 to ask the mayor a question. Next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We have a special guest in our studio today, so let's get right to it. Mayor Marty Walsh is here taking our questions and yours. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be here.
And listeners, we would like to hear from you. What are your questions for the mayor? You can give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Mr. Mayor, I know you've been rolling out a legislative agenda for the upcoming year, and I want to get to that. But first, we got to talk about what's going on in Washington. The federal government is now in day 19 of a partial shutdown. President Trump was on live TV last night reiterating his demand for a border wall. Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark told WBUR this morning that the president is using fear and division to get a wall. And Congressman Seth Moulton also spoke with us.
We got to understand why people are coming here in the first place and why so many of them are coming here illegally rather than legally. That's the problem that we need to fix. Give me a 25-foot wall and I'll show you a 30-foot ladder. The wall is not going to fix this problem.
So, Mr. Mayor, as you watch this stalemate unfold, how are you responding when there seems to be no end in sight?
Well, first of all, I think I have to say, when Seth Moulton speaks about why people are coming here in the first place, that's not often the conversation point. The conversation point is generally when you hear out of Washington, we have, 13 million undocumented people in the country. Let's get them out. I think there's a lot that has to be said there, which I'll come back to. I think what's happening now in this country with 19 days shut down over a wall is a disgrace. This isn't a fundamental issue between Democrats and Republicans in funding health care or education or transportation. We're talking about a wall. As the congressman said, you can put a 30-foot ladder on it, or you can build a tunnel, which is what one of the problems are. And I think that the fact that the American system, or most of our government, a lot of our government shut down, is going to have a bad reaction. People are concerned about it. There's no conversation about immigration reform. We talked off air about DACA. And an opportunity, is there an opportunity here with this conversation to talk about DACA? Is there an opportunity here to talk about people with temporary protective status in this country from El Salvador and Haiti and other countries? And the fact that, this president has dug in and called a national press conference last night to talk about a wall is kind of ludicrous. And I think that looking at government and looking at where we're headed as a country, yeah, they're trying to divide it by fear, but I don't think it's working. I mean, not many people have said to me that the president's right in this, and I haven't heard on too many of the talk shows, if you will, at least some of them, or people outraged about not having a wall. But this is one of the fundamental issues in Washington, D.C. That's a problem, that people in America are sick and tired of this kind of type of gamesmanship, and for the same reasons why Donald Trump got elected president, he's playing the same game that he accused people of the swamp, and he's doing the same exact things, and I think it's awful.
But if the debate in Washington misses the mark, in your view, is that something you're emphasizing to the delegation? Like, are you taking Moulton or Clark aside and saying, could we get this moving here?
I haven't talked to any per se congressperson from Massachusetts directly about the government shutdown at this point yet. What I have said publicly and what I've said, they know how I feel. I think a lot of them feel on immigration. Is there an opportunity for immigration reform? Is there an opportunity to address some of the fundamental fundamental issues we have in this country with immigration that people, a lot of people talk about. You know, is there an opportunity to create pathways into the United States of America for people who want to come into this country and better their situation, maybe get out of countries? There is an asylum program that we have here in the United States. Is there an opportunity for us to, you know, take some real bold action? And I think there is. I mean, most of the immigration reform packages that have been passed in this country over the last 50 years have been led by Democrats and Republicans. This has not been a partisan issue. It's been a bipartisan issue. If you talk to mayors around America, they have concerns about immigration. We have Democrats and Republican mayors in Anaheim, California. Mayor Tate, Republican, was worried 2 years ago how immigration and what Trump was going to do, how that would affect his employment opportunities in the city of Anaheim. And people taking jobs in the food service industry, in the hospitality industry. He's a Republican. He was worried about it. So this really is a fundamental issue that's on the street, and there has been no real conversation at a national level about moving beyond talking about building a wall or a fence or a gate or whatever it is that the president's proposing today. It's more than that. And I don't know if he's capable, he being the president, to understand the importance of making a deal here and understanding that there's a give and take. So if there was an opportunity to present some solutions to DACA and TPS and some of the other pathways to citizenship, I don't know if he's capable of being able to negotiate that. I don't know if he keeps going back to the people that elected him in his base. I'm not sure if people are willing to be able to resolve that issue right now. All I know is that here in Boston, we're seeing the effects of the shutdown. I was approached today by a news outlet in Boston that showed me the trash around the Bunker Hill Memorial Monument. It's a federal property. So we're going to send public work crews out to clean it up today and start to do some of that work. But that doesn't resolve it. There's still 800,000 Americans that haven't received a check in 2 weeks, soon to be 3 weeks, that work for the federal government that aren't doing an important job. Behind-the-scenes jobs are important about moving our country forward.
Well, so it's those workers, but it's also the contractors as well. And we know that Boston is a hub for both. It's a hub for federal workers and people who have contracts to work for the federal government. Yeah. And we spoke just yesterday with Jim Cassetta. He's the CEO of Work Incorporated, yeah, which is a nonprofit that connects people with disabilities to jobs in the Boston area. And he told us about one group of workers who were on contract with the Department of Environmental Protection in Post Office Square.
Out of the 15, 10 people have significant disabilities. They're not on public assistance. They live on this paycheck and this paycheck alone. And I don't know exactly what each of their living situations are, but I do know this. These folks have minimal savings and live paycheck to paycheck.
So there's a real-life anecdotal reminder that it's not just a Washington issue. There's a real personal toll here.
And I know Jim, and I know Work Incorporated, and they do incredible work. And the people that work with Work Incorporated do have severe disabilities, and they're incredible human beings, incredible people and members of our society. And you know, a lot of those young people, or the people that work there, they go through a program, they get job training, and they do incredible work. And Jim Cassette has many contracts, but I wasn't aware they had a federal contract. And again, you know, the 10 people that he talked about today, or 15 people, but 10 not working, they live a life with a routine. Their routine is to get up, get ready, go to work. They go to Work Incorporated. They socialize, and it's a way of life. And it's kind of we in the Commonwealth over the years have moved people from group living with disabilities into individual and getting people back in their home. And Jim's focus is making sure that people can live a sustainable life on their own with support services. And to lose this does an awful lot of damage to individuals. And I wasn't aware that Jim had a contract with the federal government. I should have known that. And there's probably one of several he has. And they're not alone. There's other, you're right, there are other organizations here in Boston and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that have these. So again, when I break it down, you know, every night I go home and I, you know, I'll read the news of the day and I'll watch, you know, MSNBC, CNN, and other stations. And unfortunately, nothing is surprising me now coming out of Washington. But the fact that we're 19 days and it's almost like a game to the White House. It's not even, it doesn't seem like that there's no seriousness to it. It's almost like a game to him. And, you know, his first press conference was with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, and how he'd say, we're going to work together and I'm not going to blame anybody. If I shut the government down, it's me. And then he flips it and turns it's the Democrats shutting the government down. No, it's not. No, it's not. If you talk to, if you get a chance to go down and talk to Republicans in Washington, they feel the same way. They understand the pettiness of what the president is doing on a border wall.
Right. Well, some of the Republicans are worried that he might give away too much in exchange because he's so fixated on the wall. And this whole border wall debate is really about immigration at its core. And you've fought for Boston's status as a sanctuary city. At one point, you even said you'd shelter people in City Hall itself as a last resort if need be. Yet it appears that for some undocumented children, even their public schools are not shielded from federal immigration officials. I'm thinking of how WBUR recently has been reporting on how information flows from Boston School Police to the Boston Regional Intelligence Center, or the BRIC, and then sometimes on to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Our own Shannon Dooling recently followed an East Boston high school student to El Salvador, where he had been deported after a cafeteria fight. So I guess my question is, if Boston is a sanctuary city, why is that information flowing from our schools to ICE?
I can't really talk too much about that because there's an open litigation case right now. But you know, we made it very clear in the very beginning when prior to the president being president, and even now, because even under the Obama administration, there's some concerns about information flowing to ICE and undocumented immigrants, information flowing. The students in our schools are safe. We're making sure they are safe. If there are kids involved in illegal activity, young people involved in illegal activity, that's something that will have to be handled in a different manner. We can't let people who – and I'm not saying that that's the case in what you talked about earlier, and I don't know the situation with the young man in El Salvador – but we are going to make sure that the kids in our schools are safe, and making sure that the young people in our schools are safe. We're working with organizations like ROCA to work with kids that might be intertwined with gangs like MS-13 and 18th Street to make sure that they understand that there's another way of life for them, and we're working to create opportunities. I met ROCA the other day in the office, and we talked about this and building a collaboration a little more in the city of Boston, particularly for undocumented kids and kids from Central America. So it's constant. I try to focus on how do we keep kids from joining these so-called gangs, and how do we make sure that they feel safe in this country? Some of them flee their homeland to get away from these same exact people that are here in Boston and in America. So we have work to do on that side of it. But if somebody does commit a serious crime, or if somebody is in the potential of committing a serious crime, we have to look and make sure that people are safe.
Well, just to fill in a little bit more detail on that case of this East Boston student I mentioned, a school police officer had identified him as an associate of the MS-13 gang. Of course, that's the one that's attracted so much public attention for its brutality, and nobody wants actual
brutality
MS-13.
On other Central American kids. Very bad brutality.
Often, yeah. And nobody wants them running around our schools, obviously, but the student says he was never in the gang. And we also have heard from former Boston Police Gang Detective Tom Nolan, who says the assessments of school police can be dubious.
Boston School Police are putting in information into the BRIC database that's oftentimes not only inaccurate, but they're exceeding the bounds of their authority.
So as you said, obviously we want to keep our students safe. But how do we make sure?
I've never met Tom Nolan. He hasn't been in the BRIC in a long, long time. And he wasn't there into my administration and Commissioner Evans' administration. So I think that he might want to have a conversation with Commissioner Gross just to get updated on exactly what the process is today. I know it's been several years since he's been in a Boston police officer.
But are you convinced that the information going into the BRIC, especially from the school system, is accurate, though?
I would hope that all – I can't say I'm convinced on every single bit, but I would want to say I'd hope that all the information goes in there is accurate. And I also would hope that if we identify a young person that could be caught up in some type of gang activity or gang life, that there's an opportunity for us to try and work with the young person and get them into a safer space. Because a lot of times what I've heard with MS-13 and 18th Street is there's a pressure for young people to join. If they don't join, their life is at stake. And I think there's an opportunity for us, if there's young people listening today or families listening today, that if you are concerned about your young person, reach out to us. Reach out to the school administration. Reach out to the principals in the schools. So we can try and intervene in a positive manner. Our goal is not to lock people up. It's to lift people up. And that means for people that are undocumented and documented, I'd rather have a safer school environment where we can teach a young person something they might be thinking of doing in a bad manner and get them on the right track.
All right, let's stick with education because just this morning you were at a news conference announcing your support for a state bill called the Education Promise Act. It would increase public school funding by millions of dollars. Here's State Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz, who filed the bill, speaking at that news conference this morning.
Every year that we fail to get this done, we are accepting another class of economically disadvantaged children graduating through our system without access to arts programming or computer science or foreign language classes or a soccer team or a school psychologist. My friends, there are no more excuses. It is time to keep our promise.
And just a reminder, listeners, we want to hear from you. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. So, Mr. Mayor, why are you supporting this education bill that we just heard about
from Sonia Chang? If we don't modernize our funding in Boston, in the next 2 years, Boston will be receiving zero state aid for our 55,000 students, and we'll be paying money to the district for reimbursement.
This is based on the 26-year-old formula.
The formula also was created in 1993. 25 years of research and education in education, changing the way that we deliver services and the way we deliver education. Something has to be updated. The system does not work for. It's not just Boston. This is many cities and towns across Massachusetts. Ultimately, this bill lifts all cities and towns for education funding. It's something that is desperately needed. It's a bill that combines the Foundation Review Budget Commission recommendations that create guarantee minimum levels for districts funding in all different districts. Today, when we sat there, we had state reps and state senators from all over the Commonwealth. We had mayors from Lawrence and from North Attleboro, from Medford, in Medford, and some other folks, East Longmeadow, I believe, that were there talking about creating opportunities. 2 minutes ago, we just talked about a young man potentially involved in gang activity. The way we keep young people out of gang activity is by fully funding and creating good opportunities for education. The way we deal with income inequality is by we making sure young people have the opportunity for a good, strong start through education. If we want to deal with the issues of racism, it's about creating opportunities, good, strong start for young people to get opportunities to battle back racism. In this funding bill, it would allow Boston the opportunity to implement the universal pre-kindergarten program for four-year-olders in our high quality in our city. Studies show that if a four-year-older gets a strong start in school, if they get a strong start at 4 years old, there's a better chance of graduation from high school and colleges, opportunities there. This also looks at some of the things that Senator Sonia Chang has talked about, English language learners, special ed. Allows the opportunity for special ed, increases in special ed, and fully funding schools in such as sports programs and art programs. We've invested in Boston since 2014, $250 million in education, but we're still paying for shortfalls from the state, and something has to be done here. This is something that's drastic. It's about the future of our young people. And working off a formula that's 26 years old just doesn't work anymore. It's about how do we create new opportunities and making sure that if we're going to do a bill, don't have suburban versus urban districts, making sure that it's across the board for all of our young people.
All right, let's bring you, our listeners, into the conversation. Charles in Roslindale has an education-related question for the mayor. Charles, welcome to Radio Boston. What's your question for Mr. Mayor?
Hi, thanks. I was really happy to hear Mayor Walsh speak on the importance of the funding education this morning, and it's really critical to update the state's education formula for many communities around the state. But Boston is an increasingly rich city, and it has a high-need school system, and I'd really like to hear what local funding increases the mayor is planning to seek for BPS students, and particularly whether he plans on pursuing revenue from full pilot payments by wealthy tax-exempt universities and other nonprofits in the city.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the call. Let me just take a step back. Again, these are typically the – not you, sir, who called in, but these are typically the arguments we go right back to. Cities, Boston's a wealthy city. Just to be clear, if we don't have a change in the formula in 2 years, Boston will receive $0 from the state, which means that any money that we have in our coffers that are going towards other services will have to go to fully fund education. And there's an opportunity there, but that's the argument that I'll hear from certain people, maybe at the state, that might say that you have the money, you don't need this money. You absolutely do need this money. And we do have the largest district. We have the largest district with the biggest amount of challenges. We have the biggest amount of ELL students, the biggest amount of special ed students, special needs students. We have buildings that were built in two-thirds of our buildings were built before World War II in the city of Boston. Our kids are learning in a 19th, 20th century building. We're making investments in those areas. We are looking, and we've made a 200 over 5 years $250 million of investments, meaning the bottom line of our school department has gone up over $250 million since I've taken office. And we're going to make another, we're in the budget process now, so we're going to make another investment. We're making these large investments in the schools and in the school department, making sure we get money to the classrooms for education. But if we don't change something at the state level, we will have to make decisions somewhere down the road on whether or not we're funding public works, transportation, or if we fund education. On the pilot program piece, we are receiving money from the college universities, and we're looking at and having conversation with them now is that they pay more money. But the issue then there is also they pass that cost back down to the student. And I think some of our hospitals and some of our churches and our nonprofits are all tax exempt in the city of Boston. And, you know, we're trying to find that magic formula. It's been in the last 20 years, it's been reworked 3 or 4 or 5 different times. And we're trying to figure out as we move forward, how do we increase more money into pilot? By saying that, just so listeners are clear, universities also partner with us in other ways. It's not just simply pilot programs. We have scholarship programs that we run through these different universities. We have teacher training opportunities. We have summer camps. We have a lot of other opportunities that we work with these colleges, universities on, in the hospitals, quite honestly, to make sure that they're enhancing young people's education here in the city of Boston. So it's not just a simple pilot program. It's a whole partnership that we have with a lot of these college universities.
And they turn out our future taxpayers as well. Don't forget that either.
They do.
Let's get to one of your big fiscal issues. You unveiled a bundle of 14 bills that you plan to send to the state legislature. But one of the focal points is housing. Could you give us the highlights? What are you hoping to accomplish?
Yeah, a couple of things in the housing piece is that we want to do one is preserving inclusionary development housing. Right now, if you can build an as-of-right home for 10 units, you have no zoning requirements. And in those 10 units, we get zero IDP, inclusionary development money, or a unit for affordable housing. We want to go to the State House and ask for a change in that. We want to be able to get a change in some of these as-of-right projects, 20, 30 units of housing. As-of-right, they don't allow us any dollars of inclusionary development money, which could go into affordable housing, or there's no set-aside for any type of low-income housing on those projects.
And you could really use that money, right? Because this ambitious goal you've laid out.
Either the money or the units.
I see.
Yeah, we could use the units too. The units go towards the goal and the units allow opportunities. And many of these developments that are being built are built in the neighborhoods, and creating opportunities in neighborhoods for people to stay is something that's important. We're working on ensuring the right to counsel in eviction proceedings, making sure that people have court-appointed lawyers in evictions so that people have some representation there, making sure that people just aren't being evicted. Somebody comes in, buys a building, all of a sudden just wants to unload the building, and having right of counsel having in that eviction process. We're also working preventing protections for elderly tenants in housing. People that are over 75 years old. What's happening? People come in, buy a home, raise the rents too high. Tenant has to move out. We're putting a cap on those elderly tenants for about, I think it's 5%. We're going to start with 5%. We'll see that either go up or go down to make sure that you can't price out a tenant out of a community. And that's something we're seeing a lot of lately. I think our elderly commission has about 900 open cases of senior citizens that live in the city of Boston that are having a difficult time because their rents are being raised. We're also we're filing a bill to leverage commercial development and build housing that creates jobs and making sure that we look at some of the money that comes out of these different projects that are important.
Robert in Fall River has a housing-related question for the mayor. Robert, welcome to Radio Boston. What's your question?
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Business Insider has Boston listed as the third most expensive city to rent an apartment in, 2-bedroom, and 7th in the world. And I'm wondering what your reaction is to that. And it sounds like your comments earlier border around rent control.
No, I wouldn't say that. One of the things when I got elected in 2014 that we realized really quickly is that we have a major housing shortage, a housing crisis in the city of Boston. We were seeing that many of the units of housing were being sold and people were paying very high amounts for their houses. And we weren't creating enough housing stock to be able to fulfill and create opportunities for people to stay in the city of Boston. So we got to work. We came up with a housing plan to create 53,000 units of new housing by the year 2030. In that plan, we have about 26,000 units in the permitting pipeline. We have about another 26,000 either built or under construction right now in the city of Boston. And we realize that our plan is we're going to far surpass our plan of 53,000 units of new housing. We at the end of last year, we have built more low-income housing in the city of Boston in a five-year period than any other period in the history of our city. So we raised that housing goal to 69,000 units of housing. Our goal was 700,000 people by the year 2030, 53,000 units of housing. Now our goal is 756,000 people by the year 2030 with 69,000 units of housing. We really have to continue to create more opportunities for housing. I've collaborated with the Metro mayors from the greater Boston area. We launched a plan in the fall of last year to create 185,000 units of new housing in the greater Boston area. 69,000 of those units are Boston's. Working with the state and working with all the different partners we have to create more opportunity and more housing stock on the market, and particularly moderate low-income housing. I mean, low-income housing is key. Moderate income housing is key as well to keep people here. But we have to, if we want to be a city that's a city for everyone, we have to continue to create more housing opportunities. And also we have to rely and hopefully get some support from our neighbors in cities adjoining, connected to us. I know Quincy's built a large amount of housing. Braintree's built a large amount of housing. Cambridge, Somerville, Chelsea. There's housing being built in all those areas. But the demand is just so high.
But you know the complaints from landlords, right? I mean, in your example, you're protecting grandma who's over 75 from paying too much of the rent increase, but you may have a landlord who says, I can't get market value for the investment that I've made. And somewhat related to that is some of the city's new rules around short-term rentals, right? You know, you've heard the complaints from people who want to list their homes or maybe investment properties on Airbnb. As of this year, they can't do that.
Short-term rentals are taking rental units off the market. And what we were seeing is that we were approving developments in the city of Boston to be built that were going to be housing and leased housing or rented housing, if you will. And we were seeing those being flipped over to Airbnbs. And that wasn't the intention of them, the approval in the very beginning. And that wasn't what the community process was. As far as the people getting market rate, people are getting market rate today. And I think that that's the positive side, I guess, of a good economy is people are selling their homes for money that, you know, I'll give you an example. My parents bought our house on Taft Street in 1967 for, I think, $17,500. A house went for sale on Taft Street a few months ago for $1.2 million, a three-family, and there's a house listed, I think, now for $1.6 million on Taft Street. Wow. It's all three families, no driveways. Our side of the street has a yard about 12 by 12. The other side of the street has a little bit bigger of a yard. There's literally no driveways. We have no trees. It's just a street of three deckers. And it's just that when you think about it, and people are selling, but a lot of people don't have a place to go when they're selling. So my concern is making sure we can keep the seniors and people in their homes. And we're creating programs in the city of Boston, home update programs where seniors can get free boilers. We've worked on giving discounts on water and sewer rates. We've worked with cable companies on this. So we're trying to keep people in their home the best we can as we move forward.
Your parents are sitting on a gold mine, Mr.
Yeah, but where are they going to go? Where's my mother going to go? My father's not with us anymore.
On the short terms, you know, Airbnb is suing the city because it's not happy, of course, with some
of these don't have to report.
Well, so are you going to enforce, in particular, the ban on the investment properties going up on Airbnb? Will you enforce that even as the litigation goes on?
Well, we're gonna force it while it's going on. Right now, we're creating the registry. I mean, we're talking about people that are most of these are investor units. We protected the folks that live in their home and they want Airbnb an apartment. We're protecting them, but these are really the investor units. We're really focused on people that own multiple properties that are using them simply as revenue generating, and they have a right to. But again, it's taking these housing units off the market, and it's changing the character of a neighborhood in a lot of ways. And I think we've heard a lot of complaints about that, and we were very careful, the council, city council and myself, to make sure that as we move forward, people who live in their home that have an opportunity to Airbnb their house, they can if they want, if they live there. And there's no restriction there. If they own a second property, I believe we give them an opportunity to rent one of their units for a certain amount of time. But again, this industry, it came in here unregulated and had no regulation, was paying no taxation, and was just overrunning certain neighborhoods in the city of Boston, where people then were deciding to sell their homes and sell their properties and because it was an investor unit.
If you see violations, will you come down on Airbnb or on the homeowner? Because Airbnb says it's not us. We're just the platform.
Yeah,
it's the homeowner.
I believe it's the homeowner that's going to get. But Airbnb has some regulation they have to apply. They have to give us some information.
right.
Let me just stick with Airbnb. If Airbnb came in the very beginning, we asked them for information. They said no. So this was a conversation we tried to have in the very beginning to understand the importance of having a conversation with them about how do we come up with a system that's fair and equitable for everybody.
All right. I'm going to have David in Jamaica play and help us shift gears a little bit to transportation. David, what's your question for the mayor?
Well, my mayor, thanks for taking my call. It's kind of a transportation question. It's really a way of life question. So I live in JP. I've been living in Boston for 40 years. My girlfriend's a lifelong New York City girl, and we have a Boston-New York rivalry. I know you kind of like that. And, you know, we started with sports, and, well, that was over in no time. We won that one hands down. But then she challenged me to a way-of-life competition, and I said, you know, wait. In Boston, we've got this 311 number. It's fabulous. You call. You get your matter handled right away. And she said, yeah, but she's look at street cleaning. She said she gets street cleaning twice a week, 52 weeks out of the year. She only has to move her car the 90 minute window, and she can do her email and everything else. And she said, "Look at you! You get street cleaning twice a month, 7 months out of the year, and you got to move your car for 4 hours. Who can do that?" You know. So she said, "Okay, I gave her that one." And she said, "In New York, there's a trash can or two or four in every intersection, and in Boston, you need an app to find one." Okay.
She's not writing all that stuff. I would challenge her to tell her. I think we have a cleaner city than almost any city in America, by the way. And I had the U.S. Conference of Mayors here in June, and every single mayor, including Mayor de Blasio from New York, who's from Cambridge originally, couldn't get over how clean the city of Boston was. And I think that, you know, we have a very clean city. We have our public works department works really hard. We've increased the number of folks they're called Hokies that go out. I think when I started, we had 30 Hokies. We have 90 now that are out there cleaning our streets. And I also think that the responsibility for cleaning streets and gutters isn't just the city. It's people who live in the city who need to go out every now and then in front of their home, in front of their business, and take a shovel and a broom and a barrel and clean up in front of their homes. I do it in front of my house still. I was doing it the other day. And I think the responsibility can't be – you can't leave it just on the city. And I would say I think we're a cleaner city than New York. And no offense to New York. It's a nice city. But I think we're – not only are we better sports fans and better sports teams, I think we're cleaner.
Somewhat related quality of life question. David was talking about having to move his cars around here. Dylan's calling in from Brighton. He's got a question that sort of relates to that. Go ahead, Dylan.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, so I work out of the Back Bay. And within the last year or two, the parking meters in the Back Bay have gone up significantly. It's for 2 hours, it costs $7 to park in the Back Bay.
Yeah, in certain ones, yeah.
No, not certain ones, all over. All over the Back Bay, all over from Arlington.
The mayor's shaking his head, Dylan.
Yeah, I know.
The mayor's wrong.
Okay,
mayor's
I'm wrong. I don't think I'm wrong, but it's all right.
Man, I work back there
all
throughout the spring. And it's significantly, it's getting a parking ticket is a better option than paying the parking meters if you're going to be parked there all day. So it's, I mean, like, if I'm wrong, I'll take that. Where am I wrong? Where should I park where it's not $7?
No, there are certain areas around, I want to say around Boylston and Newberry, that we put in the pricing there, the change in pricing there. One of the things that we did it for was to see if we could cut down on congestion in those neighborhoods, free up parking spaces for the businesses in those neighborhoods. And to some degree, it's worked in some parts and it hasn't worked in other parts. People were parking, taking the ticket, and not parking in garages all day. And the parking meters really technically aren't meant to be parked in all day long. They're meant to be parking for a couple hours parking to allow people the opportunity to move around. And we saw a little bit of relief, particularly on Newberry Street, of people driving around looking for a spot and actually were able to get more open spots. That's the reason why we did it. It wasn't about the increase in revenue. If you don't mind, Dylan, if they could grab in the studio, take your number down. I'd love to have somebody call you and talk a little bit about it, some ideas you might have. I'll have somebody from transportation,
yeah, sure.
Chris Osgood, call you because I'd love to hear from people that work back in the Back Bay just to hear about concerns you have and challenges you have and maybe some ideas you might have that could be helpful.
Well, you know, it hurts, you know, if somebody's making $13 an hour. I mean, if you park for 8 hours in the Back Bay, it's going to cost you $54 to park there if you're working. And people that have to drive that need a car to come in, that they can't rely on public transportation, that's going to be almost half what they make for the day. And, you know, you're talking about making it easier for businesses and whatnot. What about people that work in those businesses?
Yeah. So do me a favor, please. Don't hang up. Let somebody in the studio here get your phone number, and I guarantee somebody will call you in the next day or so.
Thanks for the call, Dylan.
And again, you know, I hear what Dylan's saying because I tend to go on the side of the worker. But one of the concerns we have, people, even some of the businesses, and not just the Back Bay, but other parts of the city, they want to keep the spots open for customers. And it's one of those things, it's a catch-22.
So listen, parking meters is about as local as it gets, but you sounded awfully natural talking Washington at the top here, Mr. Mayor. So
it was easier talking Washington.
All right. Well, so as we close out here, the obvious follow-up is, do you have any desire to maybe go down there and, you know, fix things yourself?
Maybe I'll go down and talk to them. I'm not.
You know what I mean, in the form of an elected office.
Listen, I love being the mayor of Boston, and I love the challenges that we have here. The one thing I think is really important for every listener to listen to is, you know, we might disagree on parking meters and on fees and on different things we do here in Boston, but we have a great city, and we're moving forward, and there's a lot of great talking points and selling points to our city. We don't have the same type of rhetoric that's going on in Washington where they can't agree on what day it is, never mind what to fund. There's lack of a housing policy, lack of a transportation policy, lack of an education policy, lack of an environmental policy, and we're working on them all here in Boston. And I think that to all the people listening from Boston and from Massachusetts, we should be happy we live here. We might not agree on every single issue that comes up, but at least we're civil to one another, and we all care about the same thing as far as moving our city and our state forward.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, thanks so much for your time. And thank you, listeners, for your contributions during that segment as well. Please stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. The opioid epidemic has affected tens of thousands of families in Massachusetts who are struggling with addiction. David and Nick Sheff are familiar with that struggle. They've written memoirs about Nick's addiction to crystal meth, and the movie Beautiful Boy, which is out now and on Amazon Prime, is based on their story.
I'm sorry, Dad. Please just give me
and
some
then
money.
Where does this end?
This is, I gotta see this one through. This is kind of working out for me right now. I got 5 days sober.
It doesn't look like it's working out, Nick.
Oh, it doesn't look like it's working out? So what, then therapy, huh?
You can come home.
No, that
we'll
wouldn't
make it work. Please, Nick. Please.
That's Steve Carell as David and Timothy Chalamet as Nick. Now David and Nick have teamed up to write a book together to share their story with a specific audience, teens and tweens. It's called High, Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction. It serves as a resource for young people to learn about the realities of drug and alcohol use and addiction. And David and Nick Sheff join me now in the studio. Welcome to both of you.
Yeah, thanks, Colin. Nice to be here.
Thank you.
We'll talk about your new book in just a moment, but I want to start with the movie. I know that a lot of our listeners have seen it. We just had the mayor on his way out saying he'd seen it, and he's a big fan. What was your guys' first reaction when you saw the film?
You could start, Papa.
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, as you can imagine, it's overwhelming. I mean, we lived it for 10 years of hell, and then, you know, we wrote about it. Nick and I both wrote books about it, about the experience. And then, but still, it was different seeing the movie. It was different. It was different seeing it, and kind of was overwhelming. But also the other thing that happened is, because the movie is so big, because we've got these amazing actors, you know, telling the story, we've just heard from so many people who were moved by the story, who it reflected their lives, who felt their story affirmed. People felt hopeful. And it was that's been really gratifying.
And for Nick?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the movie just felt so real. And I feel like, you know, the way that they told the story, it just felt so authentic that coming out of it, I mean, it was really hard to watch. But I also just felt so grateful because, you know, I've been sober for 9 years now. And, you know,
congratulations.
Thank you. And I have this great, you know, relationship with my family, and I'm married and all these things. And so seeing the movie was just such a reminder of what we'd gone through. And yeah, I just felt so grateful coming out of it. And, you know, like my dad was saying, it's just been amazing to be able to talk to people and have them share their stories with us and, you know, just sort of connect with people all across the country about these issues. It's amazing.
And the film follows a fairly long arc, I mean, over 20 or so years. And so it begins, David, with your character being very patient, very understanding, very compassionate. And then as things sort of intensify, your patience begins to wear thin. And I want to play an excerpt of the film where that really sort of climaxes.
Hey, Dad, it's me.
Nick.
Yeah. Please don't blame me, Dad. I know I did wrong. I want to stop, but please, 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 no rehab, all right? Just let me come home. I need to be home with you guys. You guys are going to give me the strength to stop.
That's not going to happen.
I wish that I could help you, but I can't do that. All I can tell you is what you already know. Call your sponsor.
Get help. I love you, and I hope that you get your life together.
I love you too.
And what we can't see there is that Steve Carell playing you, David, then hangs up the phone and is just bawling. How hard in real life was that conversation? Because we've seen you in other scenes in the film begging your son to come home, and this time you said, no, you can't.
Yeah. I mean, even hearing it again brings me right back, because that was, you know, it was just exactly what happened. And I was just so broken by then. I just felt nothing I had tried worked. And when I see that, it really... it makes me think about, you know, how lucky we were, because I did hang up the phone when that really did happen, and Nick did go into treatment. He made that choice himself. And I think about it especially when I hear from people who tell me that they did something similar. They were told over and over again, you know, by counselors, whoever it was, you know, you have to let the person you love hit bottom. You have to stand back. And they did what I did. They hung up the phone. They closed the door. And it led to catastrophe. Their child didn't make it. And so I really, since then, have questioned that whole idea of hitting bottom and that question of tough love. I feel like we need to embrace the people that we love who are in trouble and need our help. Nick was sick. People who are addicted are sick, and they need treatment. They need our compassion.
So in retrospect, you would have let him come home.
I would have. I know that's a hard one, and it's hard because yesterday I met a mom whose son, actually, because he was a crystal meth addict, became violent with her. And obviously, you know, it's different for everybody. But in general, I would say, yeah, don't give up. Keep trying.
And Nick, I mean, for you, was that what you needed, or how do you feel about the tough love aspect of things? Because it strikes me, watching the film, you really see this incredibly special bond that you two clearly have, which I think on the net was a positive, clearly, but the perhaps downside of that was maybe being too soft at times. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like my dad said, I mean, we definitely got really lucky. And I mean, in the last year, I've had a number of friends that were close to me overdose and die because of this opiate epidemic. And I guess there's something like over 200 people a day dying from drug overdoses in this country. So it is really scary, and there's nothing that separates me from all these friends of mine who I've lost. I just got really, really lucky. You know, I think for me there was some value in knowing that you know, my dad wasn't going to keep you know, giving me money or bailing me out. But the message that I eventually got from him was that, you know, he wasn't going to help me you know, by letting me, yeah, like I said, giving me money or you know, helping me in any way. But if I wanted to get treatment, he was going to be there to help me figure out how to get treatment. And knowing that that was an option for me really did help me, because it enabled me to know that, you know, when I was ready to ask for help, that the help would be there. And, you know, there's a lot of issues with the treatment system in our country, and it, you know, is prohibitively expensive, and it can be, you know, a lot of the treatments that I went to weren't even based on any sort of evidence-based treatment, and you know, insurance doesn't pay for treatment like it should. But there are really amazing people working in all communities that are trying to help people struggling with substance abuse issues and mental health issues. And, you know, the thing that we've learned is that the help really is out there if we ask for it. It can be hard to find, but it is there. And so that, I think, is really like a positive, hopeful message.
And is that the message that you're hoping to deliver in the new book? Again, it's called High. What's the inspiration, Nick, for the book?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. You know, part of what we wanted to do with High is I remember when I was going through puberty, my dad like gave me this book that was like everything that, you know, a man wants to know about puberty or something. And I remember reading it because I was too embarrassed to ask questions about like what was going on with my body and stuff. And it was helpful to have a book like that. So in a way, we kind of wanted to do something like that with drug stuff, because, you know, young people are exposed to drugs at such a young age in our country. You know, I started smoking pot when I was 11. And I really just didn't have the information that I needed to be able to make informed decisions. I didn't know anything about addiction or alcoholism as a disease. So what we wanted to do is come put together a book that young people and, you know, parents and teachers could use with young people to sort of help answer those questions and give them that information that otherwise just isn't out there.
You know, these conversations between kids and their parents is so topical right now, especially here in Massachusetts, where we've just recently legalized marijuana. And sort of on that point, I'm coming to you in a moment, Dave, mm-hmm. but I do want to set things up with one more scene from the film that really stands out to me. This is after Nick has been accepted to a half dozen colleges, and he invites his father to, you know, celebrate with a joint.
Hey, whoa, wait, let's stop. Put that away.
We're smoking this.
No. Are you that's crazy.
Well, I know you smoke.
Yeah.
So let's smoke
no,
together.
No. Occasionally,
look,
like.
Let's smoke together.
Listen, or I can just. No, stop it. Stop. Occasionally, from time to time, yeah. I will have a hit or two at a party, but it's been a while.
Oh,
so
okay. So then just smoke. Have a celebratory joint with your son.
No, God, come on.
All right, so just to be clear, the age
that was Steve Carell, not me.
Steve Carell, and just to be clear, the age in Massachusetts is 21, not 18. So that specific scenario couldn't play out, but something like that could, David. Right? I mean, you could have perhaps a college student and an adult father be in this type of situation. So I'm curious how you approach that. What kind of guidance can you give to families as they sort of encounter a new legal status for a drug that, at least in Nick's case, was a harmful gateway?
Yeah. Well, I look back and realize that was a big mistake. I mean, I had my own rationalizations at the time. I thought, you know, Nick was already using and he was already in trouble and he was sort of trying to reach out, and it was a way to connect. It was sort of almost like, you know, when I actually grew up in Boston, I remember my grandfather taking me to Fenway Park, and when I was way too young, you know, he would give me beer. But you know, the thing I worry about now is that the message that comes often with legalization is that, okay, the returns are in, marijuana is safe, we know that. And so that perception of risk goes way down, and kids need to know that, you know, marijuana isn't safe. I mean, people, all these myths around it. Kids are growing up; their brains are developing more than they ever will in their lives when they're adolescents. And marijuana does. Kids, it's been studied. You know, kids who smoke a lot of pot, it will impact the development of their brain, and that has consequences. So, to me, you know, legalization is really complicated, and you know, it's happening whether we want it to or not. So I feel like, you know, the important thing, just like we've done with cigarettes, I mean, you know, we have successfully lowered the rate of kids smoking dramatically. And that's all been about education, about, you know, doing what we want to do in this book, which is not talk down to kids, not, you know, sort of give them the old scare tactics. Don't just say no, because we know that that doesn't work. Instead, we want to, you know, we kind of they just say no with KNOW, you know, give them facts, give them information. And the other thing we do is we focus a lot on the fact that we've learned that the reason so many kids are using drugs, we think it's just to get high, we think it's for fun, but a lot of times in many, many cases, it's not. It's really about trying to deal with the stresses of growing up. And so we really want to educate about, you know, trying to get help if you're feeling depressed, if you feel anxious, or if you're having problems at home. I mean, those in many cases are the things that lead to drug use, whether it's pot or alcohol or other drugs.
But Nick, how do we strike that balance? Because, you know, as your father is saying, you don't want to use scare tactics, because if you suggest somehow that, you know, everybody who tries pot will sort of instantly descend into this awful lifestyle, when kids see that that doesn't happen for everyone, perhaps they'll just disregard the warnings and say, well, you must have been lying, and they won't listen at all. On the other hand, you don't want to sugarcoat things. And as David said, you don't want to say, well, it's legal now, so it's fine. What is that balance?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely complicated. And I think, you know, I mean, one thing that I know from the research that we've done, and I think about it a lot, you know, with if I were to have kids of my own, is they've done studies that the longer you can keep a young person from using drugs and alcohol, the less likely they will develop developing a dependency later on. So some of it is just like, how can we keep our kids from using and drinking for as long as possible? And, you know, to me, I sort of think about it like, there's something kind of sad about the fact that we as a society need these substances in order to, like, relate to each other. And I remember, like, when I was in high school, you know, my friends and I would call each other, and if we didn't have pot, then we wouldn't hang out. And, you know, I just thought there was no way that I could ever go to a party and, like, dance or something without, like, drinking or using. And there really is something kind of almost kind of pathetic about that to me. And so, you know, as a sober person, it's been such an incredible gift to learn how to have relationships with people and to you know, dance at parties and have fun and not need these substances as like a buffer. And I think for young people, you know, when I talk to them about these issues, that's something that I really try to talk to them about, because, you know, that really is the time when, like my dad was saying, it's when you learn how to sort of cope with these difficult things that life can throw at you, or even positive things. It's when you're learning how to succeed and fail and have relationships and breakups and everything. And, you know, if you're smoking pot or drinking and not letting yourself feel those feelings, then you're never going to learn how to cope with things in a healthy way. And so, you know, I think it's really cool to kind of, I don't know, just talk to young people about this and raise awareness about it, because it's not something that people really talk about. And it's definitely not something I heard when I was growing up.
Well, we really appreciate you sharing your story in so many forms, in books and in the film, and with us today on Radio Boston. David and Nick Sheff, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having us here.
David and Nick Sheff are the father and son co-authors of High, Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction, and the movie Beautiful Boys, based on their story of overcoming addiction. They will be at an Unlikely Story bookstore in Plainville, Massachusetts tonight to discuss the book. And you can read more about the event on our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.